Stop scrolling. You're one tap away from your favorite train wreck.
It's raw, ridiculous, and fueled by just the right amount of alcohol.
Actors, comedians, musicians, telling stories they probably shouldn't be telling.
Unfiltered chaos. Real talk. And moments we definitely can't take back.
It's Cocktails with Dimples in the Beard, where drinks are strong and the guests are stronger.
Check us out on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and more. New episodes every Monday. Like, subscribe, comment,
join the chaos.
Welcome to Zombie Strange, the podcast where we watch all the zombie movies in order. This week, we've stumbled across a proto-slasher film, 1959's Teenage Zombies.
No, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them, zombies or something?
Zombies.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, there's, Mr. Bill is...
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
What is wrong? What is wrong?
Hey, everybody. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
I'm Brad.
How are you guys doing today?
I'm doing good.
Teenage Zombies. We finally got Andy. We recorded an episode about the 1950s where we described in detail the rise of the teenager and the younger protagonist. And here at the very end,
yes,
we get it.
Maybe we got a little too excited for that trope to appear.
Yes, but here it is. Can't lie. Before we jump into the movie, anybody interacting with any zombie or cinema related media right now?
So I've been trying to delve into the history of the 1960s because that's right around the corner for this podcast. So I've been reading Gerard de Groot's somewhat cantankerous history of the 60s, The 60s Unplugged.
I'm excited about this book, by the way.
Yeah.
Because it's
very cranky.
It's very cranky, and it says, look, anybody who's telling you about the 60s is just being romantic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which sounds pretty good. I'm reading a book about the 1960 election. It's called Countdown 1960, The Election That Defined Modern Politics. So we are not a political podcast. We're not talking about politics on the episode. But I think there's a huge bit about the 60s really becoming when the TV comes into its own and the role it played in that election and the role it plays in media going forward. And I just think that's a huge part of the 60s. And we're going to be talking about that a lot, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait.
Well, I just watched Strange Brew, which if you remember, the villain's plot is to taint beer with a formula that allows him to mind control people. So in essence, he's creating zombies through beer.
Yes. And spoiler, that's also the plot of Teenage Zombies, by the way.
It all ties together.
Except for minus the beer, but the plot is very similar. So,
and minus the entertaining part. Am I tipping my hand?
Yeah, I don't think that Teenage Zombies can play hockey quite as well as as the Canadians in Strange Brew. I honestly, Brad, when you were talking about that, you know what I didn't realize, though? Like, I knew all along it was called the Elsinore Brewery, and it just never occurred to me that this was a hat tip to Hamlet and that the plot is essentially Hamlet.
Yeah, we're talking about Strange Brew again, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
Not Teenage Zombies.
Not Teenage Zombies. This isn't based on anything good at all. So anyway, but we have energy. Let's go.
Yes.
We got to be positive. All right, Andy, any trigger warnings here?
You know, not really. This is a proto-slasher in which a bunch of random teens, difficult to distinguish from one another, are put into danger. But this is a pretty bloodless film in all respects.
It is, though. Yeah, it does have that teen slasher vibe. But anyway, we'll get into it when we talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brad, what do you got to tell us about how this movie, this masterpiece, came to be unleashed on the world?
Well, my first question is, if Plan 9 from Outer Space is considered one of the worst films of all time, where does this one rate?
Yeah, like Plan 9, at least.
There was effort.
Ambition. Effort went in. They had a set. They constructed sets that looked like something. They looked terrible, but like, I don't know, people were giving their lines clearly, and there weren't these huge
pauses.
I was
trying to guess what the budget for this film must have been while I was watching it.
Oh, and I want to get into it, but let me say this. As horrible as like the filmmaking skill is on this film, this is a big part of horror And yes. Specifically zombie cinema, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
One of the exciting things about Night of the Living Dead is it is an independent film made in Pennsylvania for no budget by a first or a burgeoning director. Is he way better than whoever directed this thing? Absolutely. But I just want to, like, that's part of our aesthetic.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff to talk about in this film. I mean, so we're kind of bashing it, but I don't regret watching this. And I'm actually excited about digging into it.
Teenage Zombies was released on November 18th, 1959. This is the last film we are going to watch from the 50s. The film was produced, directed, and written by Jerry Warren. But the on-screen writing credit is Jacques Lecotier, a pen name Warren often used. I don't know, maybe it makes him sound classier.
When you say often, how many movies did this guy write? Jeez. Oh, okay, it's not so bad.
No, he hasn't done a lot, but we'll get into that. In the 50s, Warren made very low-budget films. In addition to Teenage Zombies, he made Man Beast, The Incredible Petrified World, and Terror of the Blood Hunters. In the 1960s.
These are all amazing titles, by the way.
All three of those are going in our podcast where we watch things just based on how good the title is.
For sure.
I think he's the kind of filmmaker who falls under the category of you make things to sell.
Yes.
Not to be appreciated or loved or highly rated.
Also very common in the horror genre.
Yeah. In the 60s, he decided to make cheaper films, and he bought foreign films.
Sorry.
When Brad said
that, you should have seen our faces, folks. It was like, is that possible?
Oh, yeah, because what he did was he bought foreign films, he re-edited them, inserted new footage with American actors, and released them. And his first one he did was a Swedish film called Space Invasion of Lapland. And he retitled it Invasion of the Animal People. Warren is quoted as saying, I'd shoot one day in the stuff and throw it together. I was in the business to make money. I never, ever tried in any way to compete or to make something worthwhile. It's not very fair to the public. You didn't have to go all out and make a really good picture.
That breaks my heart because his pictures are also called things like The Wild World of Batwoman and House of the Black Death.
Yeah, so
he could title things, I guess. That's where he spent all his energy.
Teenage Zombies was shot in 5 days in Los Angeles and at the Salton Sea, a lake southeast of Palm Springs. The house that's used for most of the film is in Mandeville Canyon. This is a neighborhood north of Brentwood that was greatly affected by the 2025 Palisade fire. And I couldn't find the address for the house to determine if it was still around or not, but it's just in that area.
Did you notice the set they used for the laboratory, like what kind of space that was? Because I thought it was kind of funny. It was clearly a recording studio because they had those angular windows, you know, and like the booth is like, that's clearly like a vocal booth where somebody's recording. And then the open space is where the engineers would have been. Anyway, I thought that was hilarious.
I didn't catch up, but that makes us even better.
Yeah.
All right. You mentioned The Wild World of Batwoman. That's a film that he wrote, directed, and produced in 1966. I think it's the only film in the 60s that's fully his and not collated from other films.
Mm-hmm.
His last film was the 1981 Frankenstein's Island. And both The Wild World of Batwoman and Frankenstein's Island also starred Catherine Victor, who was in Teenage Zombies.
Aha. Who is he?
Catherine Victor plays
Dr.
Yeah, she plays Dr. Myra, the villain. Now, also in Frankenstein's Island is John Carradine.
No way.
Oh, God, did he live a long
time.
He
is the through line of this podcast.
He might be a zombie. He's been like... Or of immortal vampire or something.
Three of Jerry Warren's films were on Mystery Science Theater 3000, The Wild World of the Batwoman, Invasion of Animal People, and Frankenstein's Island. Now, I mentioned Catherine Victor. She plays Dr. Myra, the villain of the film. She appeared in 5 of Jerry Warren's films, Teenage Zombies, Creature of the Walking Dead, House of the Black Death, The Wild World of Batwoman, and Frankenstein's Island.
What do we know if she was Batwoman in that movie?
I believe so, yeah.
All right.
And outside of acting, she worked in TV animation for Disney as a continuity coordinator. Her credits include the series Tailspin, The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, 101 Dalmatians, Hercules, and Buzz Lightyear of Star Command.
So someone emerged from this fiasco with,
With a job.
Bright future.
Oh, no, no. We have a bigger one, and that's right now, Brianne Murphy.
Oh.
She plays Pam. She's the one in the short white shorts and the two of the girls have blonde hair. She's one of the teens.
Yeah. She's the one with the fewest lines, I think.
Yeah, but at the end, she's really chatty and smiling and kind of overacting.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 50s, she and an actor friend crashed the opening night of Ringling Brothers Circus and performed as clowns. the circus, then gave her a job as an assistant to the photographer, where she learned the basics of photography. Then On the Waterfront, the movie with Marlon Brando, directed by Elia Kazan, was shooting in New York City. She hung around the set and ingrained herself and became a gopher. And she picked up and took advantage of it, picked up the opportunity to learn about filmmaking. She then met Jerry Warren and started working with him both in front of and behind the camera. Behind the camera, she would kind of do everything.
Mm-hmm.
They did several of these films. They got divorced. She then married another director, a writer-director named Ralph Brooks, and they made a whole bunch of independent films together, but he died at an early age of 43. She took this experience and continued to work in non-union films because there was no work for women in cinematography in studio films, in union films.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, the TV show Columbo, the DP was leaving, and he recommended that she fill in, and the studio was hesitant to hire a woman, but she got the job. She built on this, and she went on to do many TV shows as a cinematographer, including Highway to Heaven, Square Pegs, and Breaking Away. She was the first female member of the American Society of Cinematographers. She was nominated for 4 Emmy Awards and won in 1975 for NBC Special Treat. She received an Academy Award for Scientific and Engineering because she created, with someone else, the MISI Camera Insert Car and Process Trailer. One of her cameramen was killed doing a stunt in the Dukes of Hazzard, and she devised a trailer and system to protect the cast and crew while shooting these kind of scenes.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
And she co-founded Women in Film, which is a very large organization, and NABIT, a large union for television technicians.
She is like the most accomplished person we've ever discussed on this podcast.
Well, I think something that happens, and you see this in the Roger Corman films, they're like terrible films, but when you go there and you work there, you learn everything. And, you know, James Cameron came from there. John Sayle, a whole bunch of people come from these places.
You have to do everything because there's nobody else to do it, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like, and so she took full advantage of it. And a lot of times she would call for jobs, lower her voice, and call herself Brian instead of Brianne to try and get jobs.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
But she succeeded.
I love her now. That's great.
Yeah.
It's always upsetting when it's as late as the 1970s and we're still having conversations about women working in film. But sometimes the trailblazers aren't big, showy people that everybody knows the name of. Sometimes it's people like Brianne Murphy who pave the way and do all this stuff and make it okay for women to do this job. So,
well, I'll put this in the show notes. The American Society of Cinematographers magazine did a feature on her. And they quote her as saying that she tried to get into the society in the early 70s, but the head of the local said, "My wife doesn't drive. You'll never get in here unless it's over my dead body." And she's in it. Wow. At the point they talked to her and they said, "How'd you get in?" She goes, "Well, he died."
That's perfect.
Okay. Well, there's a line about that. Every scientific theory is one funeral away from passing into the, that's sort of how the world works, I guess.
Well, that is amazing.
She's the highlight. Now, Chuck Niles plays the zombie Ivan. In real life, he was a longtime jazz disc jockey in Los Angeles. He was also the radio announcer in Invisible Aliens, who was strangled by the alien zombie.
Oh, okay.
Steve Conte plays Worf, one of the bad guys. Many of his credits are thug, hood, hoodlum, henchman, goon, convict. He has that look that people would cast as a bad guy, and he was in 6 Jerry Warren movies. And lastly, there are 12 actors listed in the cast, and 4 of them, this was the only film that they appeared in.
I'm shocked by that fact. All right. Shall I do a very brief historical context, as this is our fourth movie in 1959?
You bet. So, you know, I'm not going to rehash the historical events that we've discussed in the past couple episodes. Cold War's going on. Civil rights are going on. All sorts of crazy stuff is happening. But John and Brad, I want to take a second and just revisit the topic of teenagers, because this is our, this is out of nowhere. I feel like this is our first movie that is suddenly a very teenager movie, right?
Yes.
So if you will bear with me, I just want to go into a little bit more specifics than we did in the past and talk about, like, so why do we have teenagers here in the 50s all of a sudden? So John, you and I have talked about how, you know, the idea of the modern teenager, you know, it really kind of emerged at this time. It's kind of a new thing.
Yes.
It didn't come out of nowhere.
Nope.
So earlier in the century, we had, in the US, I'm talking here, we had child labor laws that were taking kids out of, you know, factories and dangerous workplaces. We had compulsory education, and I hadn't really made this connection, but once every kid in the country had to go to school, you started getting this creation of sort of a shared culture that just didn't exist before, right?
Correct.
So like in 1920, a teenager in Alabama and a teenager in New York and a teenager in Colorado might have life experiences so different from each other, they might as well be on different planets almost.
Yeah. But if you're the farmer's kid in 1920, by the age of 15, you're like in charge of a team. You're like working hard all day in physical labor, and you're not going to school and meeting girls and all the stuff we sort of associate with teenagerdom.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, you know, kids all over the country are spending a ton of time away from their parents with their peers. And with that, they're developing kind of a shared vocabulary, shared interests, shared ideas about fashion. And on top of all of this, as the U.S. economy is booming, everyone's got more disposable income. So these kids who might in the past years have had to, if they have a job, their money would go into, you know, the family budget, right?
Right.
But now that everyone is doing a little better financially, these kids are allowed to keep their money. So they're using that money to buy clothes and music, go to restaurants, read magazines, go to movies, saving up
have
for a
milkshakes
car,
in the morning,
get milkshakes in the morning, go horseback riding like the teens we're about to meet. And so I guess where I'm all leading up to is, like, I mean, the teenager, it really was cemented, as with so many things in U.S. history, when money entered the picture, because all of a sudden, all kinds of businesses are basically handed a brand new target market that had not been tapped before. And boy, howdy, does every industry in the world start targeting teenagers with their stuff. And this movie, I think, is a fantastic example of stuff that was probably cranked out really fast and aimed at teens. So,
yeah. And I feel like this movie is part of that. And I feel like all the teens in this movie, like, they're all wearing jeans, like, with rolled cuffs and dock shoes. One of the girls wears a poodle skirt. Like, these are the teenagers I thought we would be seeing all this time, because they look like Happy Days. They look like the 1950s.
They look, you know, like Leave It to Beaver.
Yes.
And, you know, I want to make one final point, and that is, as with, like, the horror genre in general, I mean, anytime you have a new thing that comes on the cultural scene, you get a sort of reactionary backlash.
Mm-hmm.
And reactionary backlashes often have an ironic way of sort of cementing the thing that they're reacting to as a real permanent thing. And so there was a lot of fear mongering and concern about delinquent teens and all the scary stuff.
Going for a drive in a boy's car and, like, all this stuff.
Yeah, this new teenage world that, you know, in their defense, must have seemed pretty bizarre and out there to a lot of parents.
Right.
So you have that backlash going on. And I don't know, you have any final thoughts on that? I just wanted to revisit that in a little more depth, because I think we're going to be seeing movies packed with teens, you know, going forward. So I thought I'd pause now and talk about that.
No, I think that's great. And I think it's a good point. And yeah, this is the first 50s movies that really feels like the 50s. Instead of teenagers, we've had men in their 50s in our 1950s movies. And that always felt weird to me. And I wonder, there's probably a lot of movies we're not seeing, right?
Oh, for sure.
That are full of that, you know, James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause, all that stuff. It's just not part of our genre right now.
Yeah, it's worth, you know, when we talk about this stuff, listeners, it's worth remembering. You know, we're talking about B movies. So every now and then, I think we have found some movies that are kind of doing something new or pushing an envelope. But I have to assume that in general, these movies are picking up on themes that are already out there. My last thing I want to say is, this movie came out in 59. And this is, like, if you imagine in your mind, like, mid-century teenagers, this is it, right?
Yeah.
Getting, you know, at the diner, getting their ice cream sundaes or whatever those are.
Pompadour haircuts, duck bill haircuts, like,
yeah,
the whole
like
thing.
You're Back to the Future, you know, like, this is we are at peak, because as soon as we get in the 50s, counterculture stuff and Vietnam War politics and
60s
drugs and hippies and stuff are gonna mix into, like, the youth movement, and this kind of, so there's, like, a couple years where we have this very iconic American retro teenager, and this movie is right in the middle of it.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
The other thing it really reminds me of is I was as a kid, a reader of the Hardy Boy books.
Oh, yeah.
The way these kids act, that's exactly how I imagined the Hardy Boys.
Yes, exactly.
That,
there is a huge Hardy Boys energy to this film.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, that's all I got. Sorry for belaboring that.
No, we love it.
We can't put it off any longer. We have to face the teens at some point. So, John, why don't you start us out with a 60-second overview of teenage zombies?
If you can take 60 seconds in this plot, John, I'll be amazed.
Oh, I can. Yeah.
Take the time
here's
you need,
the plot.
John.
You want me to do it? I could do it like a Grog style, right? Teenager go to island. Teenager get captured. Teenager get rescued. No, it's a little more complex than that. A group of plucky teenagers decide they're going to have a nice day out and they're going to go out on a boat. And there's a mysterious island in the middle of the lake near their home. So they go there. On the island, they discover a woman who is conducting scientific experiments that are mysterious at first, but it turns out it's part of a plot to poison the water of the entire United States to make U.S. citizens docile so they can take over and rule all of us. The only people who can stop this are the teenagers who've come to this island. They manage to do this. It's awfully chaotic. They escape and then they are told at the end they're going to get to meet the president for saving the United States.
And so,
how's
John,
that for a summary?
That is perfect. Who was the president that they, in just a few days, they were all going to meet?
That would have been Eisenhower.
It would have, yes.
Yes.
So imagine stately Ike meeting the teens you're about to meet.
I would have said more names, but they don't say any names.
Well, I had to Google to find out these people's names.
Yeah, like at the end of the movie, it's like, they're like, we got to go back and rescue Julie and Pam. I'm like, oh, that's their names. 50 minutes into our 70-minute movie.
And Maury's the boy who was not captured and keeps trying to find his friends. Maury.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I don't think we're going to get too into the names unless you feel really strongly about it.
So I think they are Pam, Reg, Julie, and Skip. And then
those are perfect.
And then I know that a more 50s teenage names you could not come up with. And then Maury and Dottie are the two plucky teens that don't get captured on the island and bring about the salvation of everyone. So,
but I think you could be simple and say the boys and the girls for those captured.
Yes.
Yeah, that works. Yeah.
Names don't matter.
Names do not matter. So let's just start with the opening. Music, big music. It says teenage zombies. And we've got just really heavy. I think like we've got. It just goes after right away. There's like twittering piccolos up here and French horns down here, and they're just battling the whole movie.
Yes, they are. So I'm curious, when are we going to get the first hint of like rock music in one of these movies? A movie for teens would be the place to do it.
Yeah. A lot of scores aren't rock now, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
The music for this movie obviously was sourced. It wasn't written for it. And most of it was taken from a movie called Kronos, which came out in 1957.
Did that have zombies in it? We could watch that. Sorry.
It's aliens from another world send a huge robotic acculimator, invade the Earth, and absorb all energy it comes in contact with.
That sounds good. All right. Sorry. That's like the plot of Derelict, Andy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Hey.
We're listening to this other podcast. It's called Never Mind.
Would you say that these teens are lollygagging around?
They're a bunch of lollygaggers. Yeah. So they're just hanging out. They're loitering.
Yes.
But the movie gets right into it. It's just the teens are sitting at a table sharing a milkshake. A couple of them are two that don't get captured. Maury and Dottie, did we say?
Yes.
Yes. They leave the group and decide to go horseback riding. And then the rest of them are going to meet, pick them up in a boat, and they're all going to go to this island together, or they're going to do a picnic together. Now, there's a lot of banter here, right? Like establishing these as quick-witted, funny characters. You've got the soda jerk, right? The guy who's serving them their milkshakes at 8 in the morning, like you do. Like, so it's just trying to create that sort of 50s diner mystique, right? And that these are hip kids and they're really sharp and clever and all that kind of stuff.
It's got super stilted dialogue, and it starts right here at the beginning. I mean, I don't know how teens talk to each other in the 50s, but I promise it wasn't like this.
No, and I think part of the problem is, like, like Brad made a comment about like if Plan 9 is the worst movie, this movie literally does not move the camera. Like they set up the camera on these kids at the table and then they just talk. Yeah. There's no emphasis. There are no close-ups in this movie except once when there's a gun loose on the floor, there's a close-up of a hand grabbing it. And other than that, there literally are none.
And Catherine Victor, who plays Dr. Myra, said she was given very little direction. So I imagine the cameras put up, they had the script, and they were left to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of times they're just sort of standing around, and we're all waiting for some what actor's going to do something.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So I will say this. So they decide to go to this island, a little rebellious, right? Like, take a chance, be a little risky. So four of them go to this island, and just this setup feels like a slasher vibe, right? Like four teenagers. And so it had that strong vibe, and it's not something we've seen before.
Totally. They're going to an island that's like kind of a secret. It's not well known. So like they're going somewhere where people won't know where to find them.
Hey, do you want to go to that abandoned sleepaway camp? And
right.
I dare you to sleep there. Like it just feels like that for sure.
And I got to give this movie credit. We are 2 minutes into this movie and we are already on the island.
Yeah, like,
there
sure.
is none of that hour of scared stiff setup or ghost breakers. So,
but my mind instantly goes to where in the U.S. is there a lake big enough that there's a mysterious island that no one knows about?
Yeah,
yes.
Only in Michigan, right? Like there could be one in the middle of, before satellites. There could have been one in the middle of Lake Michigan. Nobody knew about.
And later in the film, the sheriff asked Maury, "Where is this island?" He goes, "You have to go 30 to 40 miles out."
Yeah,
yeah. Well, we do experience that because I would say about 40% of this movie is watching boat, like stock video of boats. Just trawling across the screen.
Right. And another 30% is watching people walk from place to place or just walk randomly around those two things. So that's 70% of your movie right here.
Okay, John, we got to...
let's go.
Let's
rein in our... We've been talking about this beginning of this movie longer than the beginning of the movie. Okay. Yes. So they are going to do a picnic on the island. They just go march around. They find a couple of abandoned buildings, and then they see a train or a group of slow-walking people. And there's a woman comes out. Well, here's what happens. They see these slow-walking people. They look like zombies to me, Andy.
Yes, they do.
And one of our characters says the following.
The way they walk. What's the matter with them?
Doped or dead or something.
Yeah. So also the soundtrack there, that's how it is for the whole movie.
Yes, there's
no tension in the action or acting or talking. So they're trying to just add tension through this soundtrack.
But the soundtrack adds tension by conflicting with the movie.
Yes.
It's fighting it.
So I will say this movie has one scene that was almost legitimately unironically creepy.
Yeah.
And that is this scene where they stumble across this band of zombies and there's a woman overseeing them. This is Dr. Myra, I think, like John said.
Yep.
And she turns and notices them. And I thought that was the one effective spooky moment in this whole film. Because she turns, she notices them, and then she just points or gestures at them as if she's like sicking the zombies on them.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool. That was the last time in this movie I felt a thrill of some sort of human emotion.
Yeah. The actress, I will say this for the actress who plays, let me get her name right. Hold on.
Dr. Myra.
Yeah. But I will say this for Catherine Victor, who plays Dr. Myra. She does have presence, right?
Yes.
She's like an old school actress. She's got square shoulders. So when she sort of turns and points, like she just, it's because of her that scene works, you know?
Yeah, she has a sort of regal stage presence, I think.
Yeah.
Is it her presence or the fact that she's always in an evening gown?
That helps.
Yeah.
She's got like short hair and evening gown, and I think she's really tall too.
She looks like she's from a movie like 15 years earlier than this.
Yeah, sure. She should be in like Cleopatra or something.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Which came out after this, by the way.
Right.
You
don't know. Sorry.
Somewhere around here, they go back, they run back to like find their boat and they discover it's missing.
Yes.
And so did you notice that like at every scene that was shot on the beach, they had dubbed the audio in later in the most comical fashion. They were always facing away from the camera and finding ways to hide their faces. So
I hadn't noticed that, but
so
that makes sense.
Dialogue that does not in any way match like their arm motions or anything like that could be dubbed in over. It's
I don't even know why,
you know, I don't even know why they would have to do this, but it made me laugh. And there's a lot of those things.
In that doing synchronized sound in those locations, they couldn't afford body mics or anything like that. So doing synchronized sound would have caught all the waves, and they knew they couldn't edit them out. So they had to.
That must be it. It's so blatant anytime they're in a beach scene. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
So they go back to the beach. The boat is gone. And here's the first genius thing to do. The boys go, hey, we'll go look around for the boat. You two stay here, despite the fact that we just saw a dozen zombies and they're chasing us. They didn't say that last part. I'm saying that last part.
Yes. So. I mean, this is so horror movie trope, though, right?
Like, yeah, right? Do the dumb thing.
This is what kids in modern slasher movies do, right?
Yes. The boys go to a house. They find a house. At this point, we know Ivan is lurking, going to capture the girls, but they don't show us capturing the girls. They show the boys walking around for 10 minutes, and then when the boys get to the doctor's house, the girls are already there. Like, so the scene that could have been action happens in the background, and then they're just here. This is this movie. Everybody says what they're going to do. We film them doing it for an extended period of time. And then they say they're going to do something else. And sometimes it's punctuated with a dialogue interaction scene.
And if something exciting happens, it happens while we're watching them do the boring thing they said they were going to do. And then, yeah.
Yeah, this might be worse than Plan 9 from Outer Space. Okay. Whew, I'm getting ahead of myself. So one thing I love is they go to talk to the zombie master. And she gives this speech, and I'll play a clip in a second, but she talks about how they don't have a boat. Nobody comes to this island. Nobody leaves this island. And, oh, by the way, I have a refrigerator with soda inside of it. So she offers them a soft drink. Then they hear the girls screaming. And Ivan comes in, and everybody's been captured. The girls are captured. The boys get captured. And then the doctor sort of starts to unveil her sinister plan.
And when people are captured in this movie, they're sort of gently prodded along
by the back of the neck. Like, get in there. Yeah.
You cut, like, they kind of get a tap on the shoulder or something to head into the jail there. Don't try to resist.
So they've been asking if she knows where their boat is. And now that they're captured, she gives this speech.
I'll first answer your other question. We've taken care of your boat, and none of you will leave here. Instead, you will help me in some very important work. No one asked you here, but your curious nature will in turn aid me very much.
Look, what kind of a creep joint is this?
A place of research and discovery. A place where science is free from the interference of stupid politicians.
Oh, yeah? Well, you won't get away with it. We've got some friends waiting for us. When we don't show up, they're going to follow us out here looking for us, and they're going to bust up this whole weird place.
Please let us go. We'll promise never to tell anyone about it.
I'm afraid that's impossible.
That is delicious.
Oh, how about that creep joint, Andy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll never get away with this. We're going to bust up this joint.
So as following the form of this film, he mentions his friends who are waiting for him. So we cut back to the diner and his friends are waiting for him. And he doesn't show up. And the wise man behind the counter at the soda fountain.
He's really the Gandalf figure in this film.
He's the Gandalf figure. Gives wise advice and says, go see the sheriff. They go see the sheriff and they talk. Do you want to go into detail on any of this? Because I'm just going to keep going. First of all, the sheriff's office is great. It's like a room and there's like a window that somebody looks through to talk to them. There's no doors. There's no,
The best part about this scene is they spend a torturously long time talking to the person behind the window of the sheriff's office.
Yes.
And then only after this long conversation, which recaps everything that's happened, then the guy behind the window goes, oh, well, you should tell this to the sheriff. So this wasn't even the sheriff. So then the sheriff has to come out and we have another. We do it again. It's just like, come on.
Yes. And in a better film, it would have been more obvious that the sheriff is in on the secret plan on the island. But we just think everybody here is stupid. So when he's trying to talk them out of looking for their friends, it just sounds like he's dumb.
Yeah.
You know what
We're
I
getting
mean?
Some real voodoo man police chief vibes where he's like, all these women keep getting killed on this single stretch of road, but there's just nothing we could ever do to figure it out.
At the end, there's such a perfect line along those lines. We'll hit it at the end because I didn't get a clip of it, but I wrote it down because it's so ridiculous. okay. So the sheriff agrees to go out in a boat and look. And while he does that, Maury and Dottie are like, well, we'll just borrow our friend's boat and we'll do it too. So they manage to get to the island somehow at the exact same beach location. And yes. They walk around the island too. So now we have all the teens on the island. They see Ivan.
Six teens total are now on the island.
They go to the house. They knock on the door. I forget even how they... How do they get out?
Oh, yeah. So
they go inside. I don't even remember what happens here, Andy.
Yeah. Hang on. Let me catch up. All right. So Maury and Dottie land there.
Yep.
We see so much filler footage of people in boats, by the way.
Yeah.
They approach the same house. Dr. Myra is in a different dress. I think this is like a day later. And
like
they
her,
just leave. Like, so she says there's nothing here. And so the teens just are like, okay. So they go back to the boat and they leave.
But
as they leave, though, they see something suspicious. And what is
this? They see a boat with two men wearing suits coming to the island. And now we know where all the soda pop comes from.
So
no.
Is it possible that this like 15-foot stretch of beach is the only like non-hazardous approach?
I think we should just assume the rest of the island is surrounded by jagged rocks because it's the only thing explains them having to pass within 2 feet of each other and be like, oh, that's weird. Like, so yes, let's just say that. But anyway, it's just two.
It does get quite a bit juicier here all of a sudden with these two guys on the scene. So carry on, John.
So one thing about this is they never say who they are, where they're from, other than referring to South America. So can I posit a theory about these people? So what we get here, and I'll play a clip about this in a second, but what we get here is that there is a plot against America, and they don't say who's doing it, but it's 1959, and we're talking about like poisoning America and taking over people's minds. So in a really ham-fisted way, this is about communism and like the Latin American revolutions of the late 50s.
Yes.
This is an attempt to try to bring that into the movie. I think that's what they're talking about. Do you agree?
It's always weird to me when these movies bother being coy about this stuff, right?
Right. Like they don't say Nazi and Revenge of the Zombies, even though it's Dr. Whatever, whatever. Yeah.
Are they afraid of offending, you know, Soviet watching teenage zombies or something? But
are they afraid of offending all the Cuban watchers of this film who are not watching this film?
At one point, one of these henchmen mentions that they've received orders from the East. So
yes,
it's the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's a bit hand wavy. But so I could have clipped 5 minutes where they just do exposition on the mysterious plot here, because again, this is a tell don't show movie.
Yeah.
But what happens is they argue about like, if anything, you know, if anything happens, this will ruin our entire plan. And there's a mention of hydrogen bombs.
Yeah.
Which have nothing to do with the plot.
So here's what I think.
Yeah.
So I was confused about that too. So I think if they can't get this plan to work, Russia is just to nuke America.
Okay.
And Dr. Myra kind of reacts with horror about that because she's sure a better way to subdue rather than destroy America. She says something about like, well, if you do that, you're going to be ruling over just like an uninhabitable land. But I have a better way to do this.
You're right. So they go down to the lab to discuss a potential solution she has. Now, the best part is she's wearing her cocktail dress. She has like these big armlet bracelets. She's, you know, perfectly appointed. And she comes down to the lab and just puts on a lab coat casually over the cocktail dress, which looks amazing.
Not just casually, methodically. It takes like 15 seconds of screen time.
This movie could be half an hour. Like, let's go down to the lab. We're in the lab. Let me put on my lab coat.
John,
let me go over to the lab table.
What I'm hearing you doing is you're committing to do like people do with Star Wars, like a special cut of this movie, right?
I'm going to do the Phantom edit, but for teenage zombies. Okay.
So they're down in their lab slash sound studio.
Right. And they talk about these drugs she's invented and how they can basically turn people into docile servants. But it's complicated, and different drugs and different lengths of exposure affect different people differently. So here's some of the direction on what she's working on here. So she shows a couple of subjects. She turns on a light and there's like a calm zombie and like a rawr, like a frantic zombie. And here's what she says about that.
If you'll notice, the subjects are direct opposites. One has no spark, no desire for anything. The other teems with rage.
What about that fellow we saw last month? His reaction was perfect.
Ivan, the perfect slave, desire to work, perfect health, and obeys every command. With half the people on Earth in his condition, we'd have the epitome of civilization.
In the bombing of the United States, how many would turn out like him?
Not enough to take care of the wild ones. You couldn't possibly drop the pellets as they now exist.
Then you must find out what it is about Ivan that produced the effect.
I've performed every practical test on him. His body chemistry is basically the same as the rest.
Well, you'll have to figure it out.
So here's the pressure.
That line delivery just kills me. It's like they're just reading off of a paper.
I know. You know, if you know what's good for you, you'll figure it out. Like, I think we should just
That was more energy than he had, though, Jen.
I know. We should just punch up this movie and redo it.
Yeah. Okay. That'll be next episode.
Next episode.
So I'll say this. This is a more interesting plot than this movie deserves. And there's more nuance in it. I really like the idea that she can zombify people, but a certain percentage of them turns into these feral rage zombies. And I think that's kind of a cool idea.
They also say they get their plot against America has been betrayed by someone named Felix. And then as soon as this happens, we cut to it's supposed to be a federal building, but it's like three windows in a building. And then
Can we go back to the raid zombie real quick?
Yeah. Yeah.
So she presents the raid zombie and the other subject is the exact opposite. They're in the same space. What does rage mean to her? The rage zombie is not attacking the other one next to him. He's just standing there flailing.
he's a rage zombie, but only against humans, I guess. It's weird.
Have we seen the gorilla yet? When?
No.
When
does
the gorilla show up?
don't spoil things, Andy.
Sorry.
I don't even know what the gorilla is.
It is in this scene. I'm just checking my notes.
All right. Yeah,
so
please.
Scene is capped.
For skipping the gorilla.
We get a live demonstration of the zombie gas in action because they put a gorilla in the sound booth and then they fog up the window. And then we are told, not shown, that this gorilla has been rendered docile. They've fogged up the entire sound booth so you cannot see the docile gorilla. But anyway, the gorilla, I don't know if it's that guy that Brad mentioned earlier who owned the gorilla suit that was in all these movies, but it's a pretty great gorilla suit.
I think this movie's too bad for that guy.
It's a much cheaper costume.
Or they couldn't afford him.
Yeah, they couldn't afford him. Ray Corrigan is the name you're looking for.
The Corrigan suit. That's right.
So anyway, so we have Chekhov's gorilla is basically why this is here, because there's a big gorilla on the poster of this movie. We have not seen the last of this gorilla. I'd forgotten about that.
We didn't talk about the poster. That's all right. You know
we
what?
Did,
That's
we really did last okay. time. Listeners, you can go back.
Yeah. All right. So her plot is to use this gas to take over people. And apparently the U.S. government knows all about all the details of this plot. So we cut to like a federal building, which is just barely a building. We go into some general's office. There's a discussion and they unveil this plan. Here's how they're going to find the enemy base. You ready? They're going to surveil the entire country with helicopters. And they're going to start in California and then go state by state. And they only have a short time to do it. So anyway.
And what are they looking for?
They're looking for just like a...
A photo of Dr. Myra.
That's right. They're
looking for a single face with all these helicopters across the entire continent.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, it's very urgent. It's so urgent because, as one of the generals says to the other,
"With your permission, sir, I'd like to also request Marine and Navy helicopters and every reconnaissance plane the Air Force has available."
"That's a big order. I hope we can fill it."
"It must be filled. Do you realize, Colonel, that if we don't find their base and stop them now, before they distribute this gas in rivers and water supplies across the nation, we'll be able to save at best 20% of the population when they strike."
Well, that's a bummer.
It is a bummer. Do you think the phrase, "hope, I sure hope we can do," is often said by high-ranking generals in the Pentagon?
You know, if you don't have the budget to like show anything in your movie, you know, just have a general be really worried about something.
And yeah, you know, they couldn't even get us some stock photos of some helicopters flying around.
Yeah, where's just a helicopter flying around?
Yeah, I picture that these are like those really goofy-looking, like, 50s helicopters.
A whirlybird.
Whirlybirds. Yeah. Anyway, all right, back to the movie.
Back on the island to the original four teenagers who we haven't seen in half an hour. The boys have managed to get their cage open. And they get out and they try to undo the girl's padlock and they can't do it.
They can't or they won't. A huge amount of this scene is spent with the boys insisting to the girls that the best plan is if the girls stay in their cage. Nonsensical. Anyway.
And then the boys are going to sneak out at night and try to find the boat. So Ivan comes in, he threatens the girls, the boys pretend that their cage is still locked. So then they go on and they wander around. So the boys leave for the night trying to find their boat. So they wander around for another 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah, we're told it's night. We're not shown this by the lighting in the actual scenes. But
yeah. And they can't find a boat. So what do they decide to do?
They build a raft with a pile of like lumber pre-cut for building a raft that they find.
Yeah, just some scrap wood lying. It's like a couple of pallets. And what's that?
And rope.
And rope. Just lying around.
They find it.
So when they go back and tell the girls that they've built a raft, there's a funny exchange where they don't want to like reveal where the raft is in case the bad guys find out. And they are finally convinced to say where the raft is, this is what they say. They say, "We hid it down by the water." Really? Okay. Well, that's
on an island that could be literally anywhere on the island, because you're on an island and it's all down by the water. But that's
all right. But back in town, though, Maury is starting to freak out.
I love this bit. So he calls the sheriff. The sheriff's not there, but the guy who stands in the window of the sheriff's office and talks to people.
Like, I don't know what his job is.
The deputy. He says, "Well, the sheriff's not here, so you'll have to go to his house." And he reads out the sheriff's address over the phone. So these two teenagers go to the sheriff's house, and they have a debate about the island. And he's like, "I know about the island, but I don't think anybody lives there." So this is the first glimpse that maybe the sheriff's not on the up and up. Not that I really knew that then, because everything is so flat, but clearly he wants to avoid it. But he agrees to take them to the island.
Indeed he does.
And they go to the island. Now, how do they get captured? Because we get back to the lab. No, they don't.
Sheriff like escorts them into Myra's house, and then it becomes clear that he's in on the plan.
But Myra and her and the henchmen are down in the basement doing some exciting science, some exciting lab work. They explain the whole plot again, and then the sheriff and Maury and Dottie come in, and the sheriff betrays them, and they get captured as well. But then he's filled with regret, and as he says, "I'm leaving and I'm going to tell the world what happens," Andy.
Well, they shoot the sheriff for being a weak link in their conspiracy.
Correct. But they didn't shoot the deputy. So
yes. I think the quote, "Didn't he know that no one can quit?" "Didn't he know that none can quit," which is a weird way to say it. But,
There's an interesting conversation about the desires of communism and how it's like a cult here. And that's a big vibe of this movie.
We do learn then, so the sheriff has been supplying them on the island, has been supplying Dr. Myra with drunks and prisoners, they say.
Right.
So basically, people from the local jail have been getting secretly shipped off to be zombified.
Which, as we learn later, was not that secret. So they bring in two of the original girls. They're going to put them in the booth, and they're going to show how this gas works on them. They're going to test this gas to see if they can get the right docile, you know, affect out of these people.
Yeah.
Then there's a huge fight. I don't even know what to say.
Well, when they pulled the girls out, the boys then snuck out and followed. And
that's
watching.
Right. Yeah. The boys snuck out, and they burst in.
So
and everybody's fighting. And
it's really clear there's no direction.
Is it fighting?
To, like the fighting, like people are, we're yeah, clearly like, just told like, yeah, just fight. So they kind of roll around unconvincingly on the floor.
This is fighting like Brad and I would do in middle school, like where we're just like sort of grabbing each other's arms and like, like we don't really have a plan.
They're rolling around.
There's no like roundhouse punches. There's yes. The one thing you can sort of see is that the doctor's trying to reach some switch, which will turn on the gas in the recording booth to turn the girls into zombies, and Dottie is trying to stop her, but she's unsuccessful. And now Julie and Pam are zombies.
Yes.
And there's this sort of bit where they're like, okay, tell us how to reverse it. And she's like, I don't know. And so then our teenagers turn into like ruthless interrogators, and they say, hey, we'll turn you into a zombie. So they put the doctor in the booth.
But why? Why do they turn her into a zombie?
Because she'll be docile and obey their commands.
Right, so she'll tell them how to undo the effect on the girls, but it doesn't work.
It is surprisingly ruthless.
Yes, so they threaten to do it to these communist mobsters as well, and they're like, okay, we'll help. And so they give another medicine to the zombie doctor, who wakes up and then destroys the rest of the medicine. Did I understand that correctly?
So. Mm-hmm. Yes. So
no,
they snap.
No.
No. Oh. No, what happens is the henchman says, I saw her making an antidote. I think it's this one. He brings it over. They give it to Dr. Myra.
Yeah.
She comes out of it, and she goes to smash it. And as it's dripping, the boys collect a few drops in a cup. So they salvage some.
All right. So that's how we get Pam and Julie unzombified.
Is that how correct. Did I like miss that entirely? I swear.
Well, the
I
mayhem
this.
In this scene is... This scene, the choreography of this air quotes, T-Rex quotes fight is so chaotic and unfollowable that...
Well, it's a single camera. There's really no cutting. There's no insert shots. There's no close-ups. There's nothing to direct your eye to anything. You have to pay attention to the whole screen to find out what's important because the camera doesn't tell you.
You know what they skipped in this movie? The one thing they could have added? Blocking. Right? Like the actors don't even move. That's the problem.
They don't know. They don't know what to do.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just listened to an interview with Ryan Coogler, and he said, you know, like my, you know what, he was talking, Christopher Nolan is a big mentor of his. And he said, Christopher Nolan taught me the importance of blocking. Like you can make a scene hum with just good blocking of the actors. Right. And like, that's just not an idea in this movie. So, and then the ape shows up, the gorilla shows up. People escape. The villains get to the boat first, but they stop the villains. Do you want to comment on any of this, Andy?
That's about how it is. The gorilla charges in and it attacks just the bad guys.
Thank goodness.
Which, I mean, yeah. I guess that makes sense if it has figured out that they poisoned it, whatever. And the teens make a run for it. Some of the bad guys are in the boat and they like, I don't know, they beat them up or they grab them or something. And then...
Yes.
So the teens with Dr. Myra and one of the henchmen escape. I think the other henchman was attacked and
oh yeah, that's right. Myra and a henchman make a run for the boat, and the teens catch up to them and
for sure
take him out.
So then we go back to the sheriff's station,
we missed how the gorilla reverted to its non-zombie form.
How did that happen?
Some of the antidote off the floor.
That's right. I forgot about that. Okay, so they just go to the sheriff's office in front of the little window that people stand in front of. They wrap up the whole
story, and the
general is there. Well, before the general gets there, the our deputy says the following.
The army will be very grateful to you kids. You know, it's funny that the picture of that woman just arrived this morning.
You know, I'll bet if that sheriff had been here, you wouldn't have seen it at all.
I guess you're right, Maury. I expect a full investigation of this office. We had a lot of prisoners unaccounted for.
Like, this is like the young women going missing.
That's where in those Voodoo 30 Man, like, prisoners
oh,
all
that explains
to.
All those prisoners that went missing, huh?
I have my utmost faith in the investigation they're going to do of that branch of the sheriff's office. So,
yeah. And then the general shows up, tells them they can go to...
They get to meet Ike.
They'll get to meet the president. They don't say Ike, but they like Ike. They're excited. So it's sort of like, actually, sort of the reclamation of teenagers, because these teenagers end up being nice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're excited. They obey authority. So it's sort of like a fantasy of what the teenagers are like. And then there's a joke about going horseback riding, and then they all drive away.
This, especially the way this final scene plays out, I mean, it has huge, like, young adult story energy. And yes. I don't say that to be derogatory about it, but like, there's this the kids save the day. The kids do all the work. It's not a story where the kids get captured and the adult authority figures figure it out and come in and save them at the end. This is a kids do something that the government can't, or that the authority figures are incapable of doing story.
Very Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Very Scooby-Doo. Yes. Yeah.
Very Scooby-Doo.
And that's a wrap, right?
That's a wrap. I don't have a lot to say about this movie, but I do want to reiterate, like, first of all, the shooting, the framing, the quality of the filming, the lighting, it's all terrible. But I just want to reiterate again, like, this is also independent cinema in the 50s. Like, we get some handheld camera shots. Like there's a couple of things, and I'm not saying that this is comparable to Night of the Living Dead. I just want to make the point that a lot of our horror movies are going to be more kitchen sink, you know, amateur, independent kind of things. And that's part of this era of horror movies.
Yeah, you know, I didn't hate this movie. I mean, we spent a lot of time knocking on this movie, and it is not a good movie. It's one of the worst ones we've seen in this podcast as far as quality of the film goes. That said, I didn't, like, hate watching it, you know? I would go so far as, I mean, something I have learned from this podcast is that there is a lot of charm to be found even in very amateurish productions. And
for
I
sure.
do not, that does not amount to me saying anyone should really seek this movie out and watch it. But I mean, I've watched worse movies that cost probably 500 times what this one did, right?
For sure. For sure. And what's interesting to me about the 50s so far, and now that we're at the end of the 50s, is I don't think we've seen that hidden gem. You know, like in the 30s and the 40s, there was I Walked with a Zombie, where we went, wow, that was a really, like,
yeah.
Like, we're at an absolute schlock B territory. Nobody, no auteur is trying to make the big leagues by making a horror movie. It's just a different vibe. And if we don't embrace where you are, you'll just be miserable. So we might as well enjoy it.
And what's interesting is that we have seen a ton of movement towards the modern zombie world in the 50s.
Yes.
In these movies that are pretty just workmanlike productions, right? Like you said, none of these are masterpieces, you know, of cinema. And so, maybe we're getting ahead, then we should talk about this when we do our questions in a sec. But it's interesting to me that, like, I mean, the hard work of moving the zombie genre forward is being done by these amateur films, I think.
For sure.
Should we jump into our wrap-up questions? We've already kind of gotten into them a little bit here. But so, hey, John. Okay. In Teenage Zombies, is there a hero party?
For sure. A very solid one. And it's three couples and they're all teenagers.
And yeah, I would say it's a very, well, we'll get to it. How does the party do? How many survive?
They all survive. Two of them get temporarily turned into zombies.
What kind of zombie are we dealing with in this movie, John?
These are science-created zombies.
Is there a zombie horde?
Kinda. There's that dozen at the beginning. They're not very horde-like, though, but there's multiple zombies.
Yeah, that works. How are zombies destroyed or killed in this movie?
They're not really. You can give them an antidote, and then they won't be zombies anymore. But they don't really get into trying to kill the zombies. There's very little trying to kill. The only person who gets killed is the sheriff, and he's a filthy traitor.
Yeah, yes. Is the world threatened in Teenage Zombies?
It is, but it doesn't come to fruition. So the whole thing is about this plot to take over, to turn Americans into mindless automatons that can be easily controlled by the Russians via Cuba or something. And that's what's threatening the world, for sure.
Part of the feeling that this movie gives of being a story for, like, younger kids is the incredible disparity between, like, the the scale of the heroes and this and the stakes of the threat. Like the threat is like this over the top, like the US is going to be destroyed. And but the scale of the story is like just a few bumbling fist fights on this little island.
Yeah, just some teenagers out for a good time.
Anyway, all right. So are there any new strains or zombie firsts in this movie, John?
I don't know if it's a first. We've moved along the path of scientific zombies a little bit here because we've got a doctor actively trying to create them and can create different types based on different criteria. I don't think that's a first, but it feels like a move towards something from, you know, Day of the Dead kind of thing. Like it's a step in that direction.
Yeah. Apart from that, I think this is our first female mad scientist. Is that right?
I think you're right. What about the doctor?
Female zombie master, but because that goes back to Cleely in Wanga.
No, there was so I don't think this counts. There is a female mad scientist in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Oh, that's right. But that's okay.
But that's not a zombie movie.
Yeah, but so, I think I will scrap that this is not the first appearance of a female mad scientist in our podcast.
Right.
And there are some other horror things that we are seeing for the first time in this podcast.
Yeah, like that proto-slasher thing. These teenagers going out on their own and having an adventure on an island.
Yeah.
That felt incredibly 80s to
me. It did. Okay, so I mean, what we're saying is there's not a lot of zombie meat here that we either haven't seen before or that really matters much in the film.
And the question is it the first Raid zombie? We had one in Maniac that we labeled Rage because of the way it behaved, but this is the first where the scientists called the behavior Rage.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
I think we can credit this film with that.
I think so too. I think Maniac is a little too incoherent to really honestly be given much credit for. John, we have a few more questions to get through here. We're going to move on to your pillars of the zombie film. Is there an apocalypse in this movie?
No, one is threatened and the mechanism that could bring about the apocalypse is tested on zombies, but it doesn't happen. No.
Oh, this next one I think might be interesting. Is there contagion in this movie?
Not quite. It's close, right? Because you can induce zombification. But I still don't think we see one zombie turning another person into a zombie.
We don't. It does feel like a tiptoe, though, towards it. So this is a little bit of an escalation of zombification technology. This is something you could like put in a water supply and the whole town would get infected. And that's not the same as, you know, a zombie biting you and then you turn into one. Obviously, we are dancing around dancing around contagion. We're getting close.
Yeah.
Are there tough moral choices in this film?
Not really. The boys deciding to abandon the girls so they can build a raft is a little selfish, but I don't think it quite reaches the heights of a moral choice.
I mean, the sheriff kind of repents of his wickedness before being killed, but that's like people making bad choices, not... a tough moral choice, I don't think.
Yeah.
All right. And lastly, does this movie have loved ones turning against you?
Almost. Pam and Julie get turned into zombies, but they don't become the Rage zombies, so they don't attack.
Yeah, they missed an opportunity to up the excitement of this by having one of them be a Rage zombie, right?
They figure it'd be scary enough that they're just zombies and that they have to solve the problem. So not quite.
Okay.
This is a movie of not quite.
All right. And so we don't always ask this question, John, but did the poster sell this movie accurately?
There are women in cages and there is a gorilla. So I'm going to say, and the poster is really low quality. So I'm going to say yes.
Young pawns thrust into pulsating cages of horror. The cages were not pulsating.
No.
And
I could see how it would be scary, though, to be trapped in these cages by this creepy Ivan guy. It just isn't scary to us.
Can we? Yeah. All right. Looking at the poster, did we figure out in the last episode what that thing is on the right side of the poster?
Let me see.
On the cage? It's like just to the right of the girl in the cage. What?
It looks like part of the mad scientist setup.
Oh, is that like a beaker or something?
It's the lab. And I think it's supposed to be in like the foreground. Okay.
Well, like a few other movie posters that we've seen in this podcast, it doesn't really accurately depict what's going to happen in the movie, but it does convey the sort of experience you're going to have watching the movie, I would say. All right, so John, turning it over to you for our 1950s questions, the last time maybe that we'll be asking these questions.
That's right. Hey, is paranoia a major theme in this movie?
I mean, I think saying a major theme is maybe a bit much, but like it's certainly this film relies on how plausible you think it is that, you know, there's your local town sheriff as part of a Soviet plot to destroy America.
Right.
I mean, this scheme, yeah. this scheme, I mean,
that's
couldn't,
pretty paranoid.
This scheme couldn't work if it didn't have, you know, like American collaborators. So
right.
I guess that said,
I would say yes, because the idea that there could be someone down the street or in the middle of the lake who is a foreign spy was a fear at the time. There's paranoia that communists were everywhere.
Yep, yes, for sure. So, all right, we'll say that. Yeah, definitely paranoid.
Now, have our movie heroes changed? Are they younger? Are they sort of more diverse?
This is what I thought we were going to get like 5 years ago. We have a radical change in the protagonists from every movie we've seen to date, because as we've talked about at great length, the heroes here are the teens. And they look, you know, they look plausibly like teens. It's not like these are 28-year-old actors trying to.
There's no Stockard Channing in here. Was she 31 when she did Grease?
Yeah. So, yeah, big change. This is a
this
bad
what
movie.
We thought we were going to get this whole
this
time.
This is what I've been waiting for this. So.
And I think it's happening in movies all around us.
For sure.
And we just
for
aren't
sure.
seeing those movies. Yeah. Science and sci-fi, are they more important? Do they take a bigger role in these zombie movies?
I don't think they take a bigger role, but certainly the evil plot is science-based. And
for sure.
There's nothing mystical about this at all. It's, you know, the zombies are the result of, you know, just a chemical substance that you make in a lab.
And I feel like, and tell me if you agree, we've left the roots of zombiedom. The roots of voodoo.
Oh, yeah.
We now have zombie creatures that have nothing to do.
There's nothing in here at all about, you know, the Haitian origins of zombies. Sure. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Let's wrap it up.
All right, John, last couple questions. Would you and I survive in this zombie world?
I think so. I feel like we could just walk
You're
away.
You're not teens.
We're not teens.
I mean,
I feel like we'd be the wise soda jerk in the diner,
or the deputy behind the desk,
or the deputy.
Well, like
the
so,
desk.
If we were the deputy, we wouldn't do anything to fix this problem, because we would be like, "Oh, another 30 prisoners just vanished." I think this plot is if they did get this into the water supply, you know, like that would be a meaningful threat. But I think there's a lot of steps before we get to that happening.
And I think we're too old to just go to a random island in the middle of the lake.
I think so too.
That sounds like a dumb idea. We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think we'd be fine.
Is this a zombie movie or a movie with zombies?
I think it's a zombie movie, Andy.
I think so too.
The plot revolves around turning people into zombies.
Yep, I think so too. And do you recommend this movie first generally as a film, and second, do you recommend it specifically to our legion of zombie loving freaks who are listening to this podcast?
I think I've got to go no on both.
Yeah.
I sadly, like, there are a couple of decent moments, but it's just too poor of a movie.
Yeah.
To recommend.
Sadly also, I hate having to do it, but I'm going to say no on both.
Yeah.
Sorry, for sure. Teenage zombies.
I think that's our first double no in a long time.
I think so, yes.
If we've ever had one, but yeah, for sure.
You can add a third no.
Yeah. Well, Lennon, absolutely not.
Is there anyone else, John, that shouldn't watch this movie?
Brad, would you see it? No.
Once is enough.
Once is enough.
I'll remember.
For sure. Hey, if you like this, remember, each of us has another podcast. I have a RPG Topics podcast called The Splat Book, which comes out semi-monthly. We just have a good time talking about role-playing games and how to run a good game, that kind of stuff. It's pretty fun. Andy, what do you got going on?
Yeah, I also have an RPG podcast. Comes out every other week, and it's called Roll for Topic. And me and my co-host Chris pick a different topic each week related to running role-playing games, and we discuss it, sometimes with a brilliant guest. So,
and the last thing I have to say is your last guest was excellent because you rolled excellent dice. You've really got to work with Chris on his dice rolling.
Yes.
It's bad.
All right, that's good feedback. That's good feedback.
Yeah. Producer Brad, what you got going on?
I'm on Multiplex Overthruster, hosted by Javier Grito Markswatch and Paul Alvarado Dykstra. We watch movies currently from the early 80s. We just watched Strange Brew and Mr. Mom and Deathstalker.
You did watch Deathstalker.
Oh, hey, all right. I remember Deathstalker.
Of course you do.
It turns out it's a very popular film for a large number of people, and we didn't know that.
Yeah, and they're remaking it. Did you see I posted the trailer for the remake?
Yeah, Patton Oswalt's
in
it.
I've seen Deathstalker 2.
There are four of them.
So
yeah.
But they're like trashy heavy metal fantasy movies, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I kind of want to see them. Okay, new podcast. Trashy fantasy movies from the 80s. That's after we finish the zombies. So
excellent.
Excellent. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Listen to our other shows and subscribe to this one in your podcast app of choice.
Or
see you next time.
Oh, we could talk about what our next film is.
So, hey, we almost forgot in our excitement over all of this stuff, but we are to the scariest part of each episode. And that is where Producer Brad reveals to us the movie we will be watching next. So Producer Brad, I don't know how I feel about your choices lately, but let's see what you got for us.
Yeah.
We are finally leaving the 50s, and not only are we taking a step into the 60s, we're jumping 1960 and going straight to 1961.
There's no zombie movies in 1960.
And here's the poster for our first 60s zombie film.
Oh.
The Dead One. Exotic voodoo rituals. Describe this poster, Andy.
Let's see. It's kind of stylish. It's a deep blood red, the entire poster is. And then in like black ink drawings, we have a pretty zombie looking guy looming over a woman in a white dress or gown who...
He looks like he's wearing a tuxedo.
He does, yeah.
And her gown looks kind of see-through.
Yeah.
No salacious surprising promises no. beyond exotic voodoo rituals. It'll be interesting if voodoo is back all of a sudden.
And I think those squares in the background are like the city lights or something. And it is filmed in ultrascope. Da-da-da. Anybody know what that is? No.
But look on the bottom right of the poster. What does it say?
ESMN. Oh, what is that?
Eastman Color. It's Kodak Eastman Color. It's going to be our first film in color.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't read the yellows. Okay.
Each letter is alternating colors. It's hard to read.
All right. So I'm excited.
It doesn't bode super well for the film, but, you know, keep an open mind.
Well, tune in next time where we talk about The Dead One. Thanks, everybody. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend. Follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.